Okay, so today we're going to compare linear and cyclic conjugation. Rehearse a little bit about allylic intermediates, which we've discussed some before, and talk about aromaticity. Okay, so last time we saw this really simple-minded idea that as you put p orbitals together overlapping in a chain, the bonding you get depends on how big the orbitals are and how much they overlap, right? Of course, the more you put in the chain, the less amplitude there is on each individual orbital. It goes as 1 over the square root of n. So when you square it, you have n orbitals that sum to give 1, right? So if you had, as we said last time, if you have 2, the total overlap stabilization is 1/2. If you have 4, it's 3/4, 7/8. And finally, n minus 1 over n if you get a really long chain. So it converges. They get more stable, but they approach a limit, right? And the limit is 1 unit in the unit we're using here. Okay, and then there's this mnemonic device. It turns out that the math that's involved in the very simplest approach to this yields a result that can be interpreted geometrically. So we have a scale here of the energy of pi molecular orbitals, right? And the radius of the circle is twice the stabilization of ethylene. And the reason we chose that is that's the limit of n minus 1 over n. Remember, in ethylene it was 1/2. And n minus 1 over n, when n is very great, is 1. So the best orbital, where all the atomic orbitals have the same sign, right? The best one is twice as stable as pi. And the worst one, what will it look like? Not its energy. What will its shape look like? If you try to make the worst possible orbital from putting a bunch of p orbitals in a row, what is it going to look like? It'll be antibonding everywhere. So it'll be plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. So it will be just as bad as the good one is good. So it'll be minus 1. So it's plus. The limits are plus and minus 1 in the units where ethylene is 1/2. Okay, so now the trick for doing this is to... It's a crummy theory, right? It's called the Huckel approximation. You assume that all neighbors have the same overlap, okay, which isn't true. And only neighbors have overlap. There's no long-range overlap. Okay, and there's some other approximations too. But anyhow, if you make this to get a simple idea of what's going on, what you do to find the energies is place points along the circumference of this semicircle, evenly spaced between those two limits. So if you have just one p orbital, that single point will be in the middle. And its energy then, for an isolated 2p orbital, will be 0 on this scale. So you have an electron there, that's its energy. And it will remember it by just putting it there faintly. Okay, now suppose we have ethylene. So we have to put 2 dots along this circumference, right? Evenly spaced. So 60 degrees, 60 degrees, okay, along the circumference. Okay, and then we have that. And of course, we know from 60 degrees here, from the that this is halfway down, right? So if this is 1, that's 1/2. That's where we started from. Okay, the stabilization of the pi, and the pi star is the same distance up. Notice, in fact, that we have the same distance down and up. So we're not taking into account that little contribution from overlap that makes the higher one more up than the down one is down. That's one of the approximations of this simple theory. Okay, so anyhow, that's the energy of, just for reference, that's the energy of the isolated p orbital and of the electrons in an isolated double bond. Now suppose we have 3 in a row. So we'll put 3 points evenly spaced there. And that's the allyl system, right? And it has that energy. And now you notice the special stabilization you get for allyl compared to what? Compared to the radical, the isolated p orbital and a double bond that are not overlapping one another. That is, we can compare the energy of this pair of electrons plus that one, the situation in allele, with what we'd have with an isolated p orbital and an isolated double bond. And you see the stabilization is of this orbital. This is still the same energy as the p orbital. We've talked about that before, right? But these are the electrons that get stabilized. Okay? And now that's interesting. It has nothing to do with the energy of that electron, right? So if you put another electron in, this would still be the amount of stabilization that you got from conjugation. Or if you took this electron out, this would still be the energy that you get by stabilization. Okay? So it's the same two electron stabilization, whether you're talking about the allyl cation, which loses an electron, the allyl radical, which has that electron, or the allyl anion, which has two electrons there. They all are stabilized, right? Furthermore, notice that when you have an odd chain, this one that's in the middle here with n equals 3 is non-bonding. It's not bonding, it's not anti-bonding. It's non-bonding. It's the same energy as an isolated p orbital because there's no overlap, because you have a node every other atom. Okay? So no overlap means these have the same energy as an isolated p orbital. Okay? Now, and you know that it's going to be that way if you have an odd chain, because the best orbital is going to be all with the same sign. The worst orbital is going to be changing signs every atom, right? And this one then is going to be right in the middle, right? When you have an odd number of orbitals that you're talking about. Okay, so odd chains have a non-bonding with nodes. And now that has an interesting thing with respect to where the functionality is going to be, where there's going to be a plus charge if it's a cation, where there's going to be a minus charge if it's an anion, where there's going to be a SOMO if it's a free radical. You see that if when this electron is here, it's going to be here, 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 every other atom. So that's where the radical will be, right? If you take that electron out, that's where the charge will be, the plus charge. If you put another electron in, that's where the minus charge is. And that's the same picture you get by writing resonance structures where you put double bond, dot, or move the double bond, put the dot there, and so on. It turns out to be every other one. And the reason it works to draw it that way is because that's what the orbital is that you're dealing with. On an odd chain, it's every other atom. Okay, now if you have butadiene with n equals 4, it's not an odd chain, so you don't have that property we just talked about. But those are the energies of the orbitals you have. Now, what we would compare the stability of butadiene to see its conjugation energy with two isolated double bonds. So we'd have two double bonds, and you see one of them is stabilized and one destabilized in butadiene compared to the isolated ones. Okay, so the difference in these two is then the resonance stabilization of butadiene versus two ethylenes. Okay. Now, and as the conjugated chain lengthens, you can see what happens. You're putting more and more of these dots in here. The ones below the middle are occupied. The ones above the middle are vacant. Right? But the lowest one is going to approach minus 1. The highest one is going to approach plus 1. Right? But all these things, remember, were evenly spaced along the circumference, along the perimeter. Right? But the energies are not evenly spaced. The biggest energy is here. So that's the gap between the HOMO and the LUMO. That tells you how high the HOMO is, how low the LUMO is. That's how reactive these things are going to be. Right? But notice that the more dots you put in there, the higher the HOMO gets and the lower the LUMO gets. So it gets more reactive as you get a longer chain. And furthermore, if you're interested in color in the absorption of light, by taking an electron from the HOMO and putting it into the LUMO, the longer the chain, right, the redder the light is, the lower energy, the light you need. And this is taken into account. I mean, this is why Bugs Bunny eats carrots, right, to help his eyes out, because carrots have this long chain of double bonds. And we'll talk about that again later when we're shortly when we begin to talk about spectroscopy. Okay. Now, these allylic systems, as we've mentioned before, are unusually stable, and therefore you get special reactivity when you have the possibility of getting an allylic intermediate. So, for example, as you read here in the book, cholesterol benzoate, which has a double bond here, can react, they say, with bromine and light to put bromine in this position. Right? Look at all the different positions you could react with. What might you think bromine would, if I hadn't told you that this can happen, if the book hadn't said that this can happen, what would you have expected to be the reaction of Br2 plus this compound? Brian? Right, you'd add Br2 to the double bond. That's what we've been talking about. Right? But what's special here is that they used light to make free radical reactions, right? So there's going to be a competition between an ionic reaction, which adds BRs through the, remember, the bromonium ion, the three-membered ring, and this free radical reaction, which puts a bromine here. Now, how does it do that? It's because it's a chain, a free radical chain reaction, so it can pull off a hydrogen from a carbon next to the double bond. Remember, the electrophile, Br2, would attack the double bond directly. But this takes the H next door in order to generate an allylic radical. Right? Actually, as I copied this from the book, as you can see, and it's rotated by 60 degrees. Rather, this is the place the H came off from, here. So you could write a radical here, or you could put the double bond here and write the radical there for this allylic radical. And then in the second reaction of the propagation, this is the machine running round and round. First you pull the H off, and then you put bromine on by one or the other of these radicals attacking Br2, which could put the new bromine here, or it could have put it down there. In this particular case, they're the same, the product. Okay, yeah.
So is the ring moving, or is the double bond and resonance structure moving from one side?
From here to here, the fact that that's on the left and that's on the top is just the artist's mistake. He should have written the first one. I mean, it would have taken a little extra space on the page to put that on top. It wouldn't have taken any extra space to put the dot here and the double bond here. And in this one, the double bond here and the dot there. But anyhow, that's the way they wrote it. So that's called allylic substitution. Now you're going to have a problem here, because it turns out that you can get both these reactions, addition and allylic substitution. How do you help get the one you want? The addition turns out to be second order in Br2. That seems weird. What does a second molecule of bromine have to do with one molecule of bromine adding, giving Br plus to the alkene? Okay. What it does is help Br minus leave. So a second Br2 comes in and it forms Br3 minus instead of Br minus. Okay, so that helps the reaction. So that means if you have the minimum concentration of Br2, then you favor this reaction because you don't have enough bromine to have the addition reaction occur to get Br plus. Okay? Now, there's a trick that allows you to do that. So the more common way, rather than just using bromine, as was shown with that cholesterol, and I actually am not sure about that reaction, whether they really used just bromine or whether they used this special reagent, which would be much more complicated, much more common. That special reagent is called NBS, for N-bromo-succinimid, this five-membered ring with two carbonyls, and nitrogen is called succinimid, and this is N-bromosuccinimid. And it has the property that it reacts with HBr. I'm sorry for the low resolution here. I made a mistake while making this slide. This is in the book. It reacts with HBr to give succinimid itself and Br2. Right? So that's a very rapid reaction. And that's the key to this, to being able to get this allylic bromination. Because what you want is the minimum amount of Br2. Even if you put in just one equivalent of Br2 at the beginning of the reaction, there's a lot of Br2 there, right? So you get addition as well as this substitution reaction, right? But if you just put in the tiniest amount of Br2, right, and NBS, then every time this reaction occurs, every time you cycle, you generate a molecule of HBr. That molecule of HBr reacts with NBS to generate a new molecule of Br2. So it automatically maintains the tiniest amount of Br2 there. Right? So that's the trick to doing this allylic bromination. It's a clever idea. You might think you could do the same thing with chlorine, but you can't, because the chlorine atom is less selective. So it only takes the allylic hydrogen, the one called A here, about twice as often as an unactivated hydrogen. So it's not going to be specific the way bromine is. We talked last quarter about bromine atom being more selective than chlorine. But this NBS allylic bromination is a very common reaction. Now, that's allylic radicals. Allylic cations are also important. So you could imagine adding HCl to a diene instead of just an alkene. And now it can add either at a terminal position, the H+ could add either at the terminal position or the central position. So you can get either this cation or this cation. This one's primary. This one's not only secondary, it's also allylic and substituted. Subject to resonance stabilization. So no surprise, you don't do this, you get this. But even having done that to get this cation, that is to say this cation, the chloride that then adds in the second step could add either here or here. So if it adds here, then the addition is said to be 1,4. You add it to the number 1 carbon and also to the number 4 carbon. But the alternatively, you could add here and you could get 1,2 addition. Now, which of those products would you expect to be more stable? 1,2 addition product or 1,4? Would you rather have the double bond in the middle of the chain or at the end of the chain? In the middle, that's always the way it's, right? Now, let's look at the reaction, right? Here, when you add HCl at low temperature, it's 3 times as much at the end of the chain as in the middle of the chain. That's not what you would expect. So let's try to understand why it does 1,2 addition rather than 1,4 addition. Okay, so here's butadiene, and here's the cation you get when you add this hydrogen to the CH2 group. So this is the allylic cation. Okay? Now, this is the HOMO of the butadiene, or pardon me, the HOMO minus 1, that's the lowest pi orbital, right? All same sign. What's the next one going to look like, the HOMO? Yeah?
There'd be one node in the center.
Node in the middle, right? There we go. And just to rehearse what we said earlier in the class, what will the next one look like? 2 nodes, right? There it is. And the very highest pi orbital will be 3 nodes. Okay, so which one are you most interested in if you're H+ coming into attack? Which of these pi orbitals? Shirley, what do you say?
The one with...
Pardon me? The one with one node, right? The HOMO. So there's the one you're interested in. Now, if you're H+, where should you attack? Well, that's the place you get the best overlap. Okay, that's a little bit like Berge-Dunitz kind of thing. Okay. On the other hand, you might see where the most favorable electrostatic place to be on the surface is. So you could look at the charge, remember, on the surface of the molecule, the way we've talked about the surface potential, and you find that a proton would be very high in energy here. That's in the sigma system, big surprise, but low in energy here. So the reddest place is about here. So that's where the best potential would be. So those two things should both be important, right? Where it's going to be happy electrostatically, but also, and not necessarily the same thing, where it can begin to get overlapped to form the bond. Okay. So you see that where it's going to attack is in here near that carbon. Okay, so then it will give the product we show on the right. That's certainly the best product, the one that has allylic stabilization, as opposed to attacking this carbon where you get a primary cation. Yeah?
Why would you be interested in the homo-minus one with the better overlap?
No, that wasn't homo-minus one, it was homo.
Why aren't you interested in the homo-minus
one? Because you're looking, the homo is the one that you get the best energy match with. The H plus is the low LUMO. You want the highest HOMO to get a form a new bond. Okay, now let's look at the orbitals in this allylic cation. HOMO minus 4 is not a very interesting orbital, right? But I'm showing it to help understand better the others. What it is, you can see, if I fade it and then bring it back a little bit, is hyperconjugated sigma CH. So here's sigma CH, right? And mostly this electron is this CH bond and this CH bond. But a little bit, it's overlapping with the p orbital here of the allyl cation. That's a hyperconjugation, right? The allyl cation stabilizing these electrons. So that's not important, except to see that is why in the HOMO you have a little bit of this out here, right? Because in the CH bonds there was a little bit of the pi, and in the pi there's just a little bit of the CH bonds. Okay, but this is not, that's very small and not relevant. This is the HOMO, right? And that's the LUMO with one node, and that's LUMO plus one with two nodes, right? Now, which one of these is important now? What's the next step going to be? We've generated the alkyl cation, the allyl cation. What happens next?
Cl
minus comes in. So what it's interested in, being a high HOMO, is the low LUMO. Right, so it's not going to be interested in LUMO plus 1. It's going to be interested in the LUMO. Now, where should the chloride attack? Okay, well, the best overlap would be either of those two positions. Maybe favored on the left a little bit. Right, and if we look at where the charge is, the surface potential, it looks like this. The best place, the best place for chloride would be where a proton has the highest energy. So here, this is a cation, so protons don't like to get near cations. So it's bad to be in this red region. It's even worse to be in this blue region if you're a proton. But you're not a proton, you're a chloride anion, so it's just the opposite. So the best place to be for a chloride is to attack here, but that's in the sigma system. There's no way to form a bond. That would be the best place to sit, but not a place where you could react. So let's look at a place you could react where you could be overlapping with the LUMO. Okay, that would be up on top. And now I've changed the scale a little bit so you can see these colors more clearly here. So you could attack here, which is, that is on top here, or here, right? Which is plus 132, but better is this place here. That's the best pi place to be. if you have to be pi in order to get overlap and form a bond, that, as far as where the charges are, is the best place to be. So then you might use this kind of argument to say, this is a better place to attack than this place, by, you know, that's a, for what it's worth, something like a dozen kilocalories per mole. So we can say, aha, this is the reason that you get 1-2 addition. So H plus added here first, and then chloride adds here rather than here. So it's 1-2 rather than 1-4 addition. So people say that kind of thing. But there's a really neat experiment that's mentioned in the book that was done in 1979, published in Journal of the American Chemical Society, which is this one, where they used a diene that had an extra methyl group on it and added DCl, so you can tell where that particular hydrogen went because it's deuterium. Okay? So, of course, it's no surprise that the D plus adds here rather than here, because it gives a more substituted allylic cation. Okay? So you're going to have this intermediate. And now the chloride could add either 1-2 or 1-4. Okay? Now, do you see what's neat about doing the reaction this way? Which one do you expect to happen? Do you expect there to be a big discrimination? What was really clever about choosing to have a methyl group here when you make a new methyl group there? Yeah. It's symmetrical, except for the deuterium instead of hydrogen, which is a negligible perturbation, I'm sure, in this case. Except for that, it makes no difference. Right? It's a symmetrical compound, so it should be just as easy to add 1-2 and 1-4. Now, what was found was this. They tried several different solvents and at different temperatures. The results are consistent, but let's just look at what happened when they used really low temperature here, at room temperature. They got 1.6 to 1, not 1 to 1. Right? So it prefers 1-2, even though the cation is symmetrical, so it can't possibly have anything to do with those charge distributions that we saw before. Okay, and if you do it at minus 78 degrees, it's 3-1. Now, why should this be? Can anybody see why it could be that the chloride prefers to go here rather than here? It can't be these explanations that I gave before. Can't hear Roa. Say louder, please.
If you add H plus to that end, the negative chloride would prefer to be on that end rather than the
chloride. Why would the chloride prefer to be on that end?
The chloride is negative.
Yeah, but once the deuterium is added, the H plus isn't on that end. The H plus is in the plus charge is in the middle, symmetrically distributed, right? Yeah. Aha! Look at this. So if we attack DCl to get the proton, the chloride is generated there. So it's closer to get... So the reaction must happen really quickly. There must be this pair of ions, chloride, cation, and the cation must react with the anion very, very quickly before these things can move relative to one another. So the shortest path is to attack 2, and it's longer to attack 4. So it reacts very, very quickly. Did you ever see a thing like this before, where the product is determined by the rate of motion of things rather than by where something is more reactive? Pardon me? Can't hear very well.
Joe David Fine,
you're right on. There it is. That's exactly this case where it was a question of rotation being the thing that controlled which product. So that seems to be, at least in this case and probably in most cases, the real explanation. It's not this stuff that has to do with surface potentials or subtle differences in LUMO shape, right? In this particular case, it seems to be just that it happens very quickly before you can move much. Okay. Now, another interesting thing about this 1-2 versus 1-4 addition is it's a great example of kinetic versus thermodynamic control. So look here. We'll take butadiene and add HBr at really low temperature, and you get 4-1, 1-2 versus 1-4 addition. That's the kind of thing we just saw. Okay. But if you do the same reaction at room temperature, not only does it become less favored for 1-2, it's actually favored to give 1-4 product. It turns around. It's not just less. It changes in the opposite direction. So there must be something else going on at the higher temperature. Right? Now, if you take pure samples of the 1-2 and 1-4 dichloride, right? So that is, these weren't formed at 100%, but they were formed as a mixture and then separated, right? So you have, if you take the 1-2 and treat it with zinc chloride at room temperature, you get a mixture of 1-2 and 1-4. If you take the 1-4 and treat it the same way, you get the same mixture of 1-2 and 1-4. In other words, it reaches equilibrium. And at equilibrium, as you expect, Christine was told me, wasn't it, that it should be in the middle. And indeed it is. 70% of it's in the middle, 30% terminal double bond. That's what you expect. So this is the result of equilibration. And this is the result of equilibration. Right? So if you had the 1-2 and the 1-4, they could lose chloride, especially when that zinc was there to help pull chloride off, right? You get this, and now it can go on either place, but it goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and reaches equilibrium. But if you do it just once, and under conditions where you formed the chloride near the 2-carbon, right? Then if you do it just once, you get 1-2. But if you let it sit around so that it can come to equilibrium, then you get 1-4. So that's called kinetic versus equilibrium or thermodynamic control, right? The fastest thing versus the most stable thing. Okay, so that's an important lesson to remember, is the difference between kinetic and thermodynamic control. Right, and as we said then, if it's kinetic, you get 4-1, 1-2. And if it's thermodynamic, you get a slight excess here of 1-4. It probably hasn't reached equilibrium there at that point. Okay. And I just put these in because there are these two tables in the book at this juncture, which we've already talked about before, that in SN1 reactions, allylic makes things much faster. Right here it's 14 times faster. Here if it's a more stable allylic, it's lots faster. Okay, and we also saw that a lecture or two ago that the same thing is true in SN2 reactions, that the transition state is accelerated if you have the double bond next door. So these are all examples of allyl cations, allyl radical, allyl anions all reacting rapidly. And, oh, pardon me, I hadn't mentioned the anion yet. Here's the anion. If you look at the RH acidity, remember for a normal alkane, it's in the range of 50 to 60. But for an allylic one to make the anion, it's seven or more orders of magnitude easier. Right? So remember, all this is what we were saying, that the allylic system, which has one electron whose orbital is the same as a p orbital, and the other one stabilized relative to a double bond, right? That stabilization is the same, whether you're a radical, cation, or anion. They're all reactive. Okay, and much the same thing is true in benzylic intermediates, which are just mentioned in passing here. But the, for example, the pKa is 41, so it's even more acidic. We may have time a little bit next lecture to talk a little more about benzylic things, but maybe not. Now, cyclic conjugated systems. Okay, let's first look at the heat of hydrogenation. Okay, so if you add H2 to this double bond, right, you give off 28 kilocalories per mole. Now, suppose you had two double bonds. What do you expect to get out if you're really naive? Suppose you have cyclohexadiene and you're going to add two hydrogens. What's the guess? Double, right? So 56. Okay. In fact, the second one, you get out only 55. Right? The second one is only 26. Why? Yeah. There's this little bit, a few kilocalories of stabilization due to conjugation. So you don't expect as much from the second one as you got from the first one. The starting material was a little more stable than you expected. Now, suppose you put three double bonds in the ring. Now what do you expect for the next increment up here if we put three double bonds and come down to here or all the way? Yes? Madeline, you guess for me. Pardon me? 24. That seems very reasonable extrapolation, right? So you'd predict 24 and a half. You're right on with the prediction. However, it's actually the total to go from here to here is 49, right? It's less than from here to here. So that last one is negative. Isn't that weird? You see what I mean? This one is more stable than that one with respect to the hydrogenation. Right? So there is conjugation in this case. Although conjugation here was worth 2 or 3 kilocalories per mole, this one is worth 30 kilocalories per mole. We expected it to be up there. And in fact, benzene is down there. So benzene is really something stable. Now, why is it true that you get another bond worth almost, right? Remember, it's almost another bond's worth. 30, well, I mean, the double bond, remember, the pi bond is worth 60. So half of a bond you're getting, lots more than this couple kilocalories per mole. Can you see why that is? This is the subject of aromaticity. So in the ring, you've essentially taken a chain of p orbitals and brought the ends together. Right? Now, what is the effect of bringing the ends together? Let's look at that. Now the lowest MO, instead of being n minus 1 over n, remember how we said, now there's an extra bond in there, so it's n over n. It gets lower. Okay? So in a conjugated ring, nodes, as you go around the ring, must come with even numbers. Right? Consider cyclopropenyl. So here's cyclopropene, double bond, ill, take a hydrogen off from cyclopropane. So we have three p orbitals in a ring. Now this one obviously has no nodes, right? So, and its energy will be minus one. It has three of these things, each one over the square root of three. So that's at the very bottom of that circle we talked about. No nodes. Now we're going to go to the next orbital. How many nodes are we going to have? If the what?
One.
Now, that in a sense, you're right. But look at this. As you go around the ring, there's a node here and a node there. There are two nodes as you go around the ring. Right? There have to be. Because you get back to where you started. Right? Or you could say there's one planar node like this. Okay? But you can also have this one, where as you go around the ring, you have a node here and a node there. And it has the same energy. So these two orbitals have the same energy, and each has a pair of nodes. So instead of having no nodes, one node, two nodes, three nodes, you have zero nodes, two nodes, four nodes, six nodes, right? So let's look at how these orbitals of butadiene shift in their energy as you bring the ends together. So that's the lowest energy orbital, right? And if we bring the ends together, that's going to be favorable, right? So that orbital will go down in energy. How about this orbital when we bring the ends together? Right? It'll go up in energy. How about the next one? Down. And the next one? Up. Right? So as you can see, because of the parity of it, every other one is go up, down, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up. And these two come out to be the same then, as we just saw in the cyclopropyl case. So the shifts alternate because of the parity of the number of nodes. So when you bring the ends of the chain together, odd-numbered MOs, 1, 3, 5, decrease in energy because you have favorable overlap, and the even ones go up. Right? Thus, if you have an odd number of occupied orbitals, more odd-numbered than even-numbered, then you're going to win, right? Because more are going to be going down than going up, compared to having a chain. Although, of course, you can still make... cyclopropenyl is still bad because it's bending the sigma bonds. But as far as the pi electrons go, that's good. And this gives rise to what's called Huckel's rule. Huckel was a physicist who, within about 2 years of the discovery of quantum mechanics, figured this out. And organic chemists finally tumbled to what he had figured out about 30 years later. And became very excited about it at that point. Even though his brother was an organic chemist who wrote a big textbook about organic chemistry, but somehow the concept was mostly lost. So if you have 4n plus 2 pi electrons, it's unusually stable where n is an integer. And why? Because that means that there's an odd number of pairs, an odd number of occupied orbitals. Right? If they come in pairs, that means you have 2n plus 1, right? That's an odd number. So more of them are going to be going down on forming the ring than going up. So it's going to be unusually stable compared to having the chain. So for this one, you can use a circle again, but a full circle, right? And it's the same radius as for the open chain. And now you inscribe a regular polygon with a point down. So for cyclopropenyl, you do this one. Now the bottom one is going to be at minus 1, because remember it's n over n, minus 1, because every one is going to be overlapped. So it's always going to be that the bottom one is down here at the bottom. Right? But then the others are going to come in pairs that you can find the position of by drawing this regular polygon. So for a cyclopropenyl, we can read the energies on this scale, and that's what they are compared to an isolated p orbital, which is at zero. Right? So there's the cation, you see, is very strongly stabilized compared to the acyclic allele plus, the three p orbitals in a row rather than in a circle. So we already saw allele, where the cation had no electron here, two electrons here. But in the cyclic one, right, you get that much stabilization for two electrons. So the cyclopropenyl cation should be very stable, right? Now, the radical should be less stabilized because although these two got stabilized, the extra electron went up in energy when you went from the chain to the ring. Okay? And if you have the anion, then it's going to be destabilized compared to the allyl anion because this is going up more than this is going down. So the cyclopropenyl cation should be aromatic, unusually stable. The radical should not be so stable, and the anion should be unstable, hard to make compared to what? Compared to a chain that's not in a ring. Okay, so now how about if you have four atoms in the ring, cyclobutadiene. Okay, now you have those for the energies. Two electrons down here, but these two orbitals have the same energy. So those will turn out to be SOMOs. They'll be very reactive. And even if the two electrons decided to go in one, you have a very high HOMO and a very low LUMO. So cyclobutadiene should be very, very reactive and not stabilized compared to its to the chain butadiene. Here are the electrons in the chain, and when you make it into a ring, these don't go down as much as these go up. So this is anti-aromatic. It's destabilized compared to the chain. Okay, if you have benzene, this is the classic example of aromaticity. That's where the name came from, right? You have this. Now, if we had hexatriene, the same six orbitals in a chain instead of in a ring, these would have gone down, these went way down, and these went a little bit up. So benzene is quite stabilized. 30 kilocalories per mole is what we just saw about its unusual stabilization. Okay, so this... we can generalize this concept of special stability associated with 4n plus 2 electrons in the pi system of a ring. And it also applies for transition states that have that property, and I'll show you a little bit of that shortly. So heteroaromatic compounds, it doesn't have to be all carbons in the ring. For example, pyridine, let's look at the electrons of that. Nitrogen has an unshared pair that's irrelevant to the pi system because it's in the plane, right? It doesn't overlap with that. But it has one electron coming in and out of the board, and that's part of this double bond. I show it, and this is to warn you, that although I show that, that's just to say that that's in the pi system. It's making this double bond, right? So that has six pi electrons, 4n plus 2 pi electrons. So that should be stable, aromatic. Furan, should that be aromatic? Right? Well, it has two electrons in the sigma system, but now a pair of electrons in the pi system, right? Because oxygen has two unshared pairs. So this again has six electrons in the pi system and should be unusually stable. Or pyrrole, right, where the nitrogen has two electrons in this pi system, unusual stability. Or the most interesting one may be imidazole, which has two nitrogens in it. Now let's try to see how many are in the pi system. There's a pair here. This one contributes one, which is part of that bond. So 2, 4, 6, that's aromatic too. So all of these heterocyclic compounds with other than just carbon in the rings are unusually stable for this reason. Right? And one final note here about imidazole, which occurs in the amino acid histidine. It's great for transferring protons long distance in biological systems. Okay. It's a relay for proton transfer because you can have a proton available here, something that can take up the proton here but can't reach it. But it can take the proton from there, and now you get the imidazole turned around and the proton has in effect been transferred. Okay, so we'll do a little bit more of this aromaticity stuff next time. And then there's going to be an exam, as you know, on Friday. So we'll have a review session Wednesday night.
Hey, can I ask you two questions?
Yeah.